Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, Bill Pullman from Independence Day and While You Were Sleeping to The Sinner. Hey guys, I'm Josh Horowitz. Welcome to another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. I'm back from the Toronto Film Festival. If you listened to last week's episode, you know I was knee-deep in lots of movies. 20 in all, by my count. I think it was 20. I might have seen more or less. I don't know. My brain was mush by the end of my 9 days in Toronto. But I'm very pleased to be back in the home office, in my strange little office, doing my extended conversations with the likes of Bill Pullman. This feels right. Bill Pullman is the guest on today's episode of Happy, Sad, Confused. And what a pleasure. What a distinct pleasure. Who isn't a fan of Bill Pullman? For as long as I can remember, I've loved his work. From his film debut in Ruthless People, to Spaceballs, to Independence Day and While You Were Sleeping, through Lost Highway with David Lynch, all the way up to and including this great series that he's on right now, which I just discovered, actually. I mean, I'd heard about it because it got some Emmy love for Jessica Biel in the first season. The show is called The Sinner. It is on USA. As you listen to this, if you're listening to this on Tuesday or Wednesday, the finale airs tonight on Wednesday. If not, you can go back and listen to, or rather watch the whole season, I'm sure, on demand, etc. I did it that way, actually. I watched the 7 episodes of season 2 in the span of, I think, 2 or 3 days, and it's great. It stars, the only continuity between the first and second season really is Bill Pullman's character, detective who in season 2 kind of returns to his hometown to investigate a double homicide seemingly perpetrated by a child. And that's kind of where I'll leave it off. It's the less said, the better. But it stars Pullman as this kind of quirky, odd detective with some demons and eccentricities, but also stars the likes of Carrie Coon and Tracy Letts. It's a great ensemble, and it's really well done. So I definitely recommend checking out The Sinner if that sounds like it's your bag. And this was a delight of a conversation. Bill is, kind of an actor's actor in a way. Like, you know, you think you associate him with the kind of mainstream, I think, a lot of romantic comedies back in the 90s and late 80s. But this is a guy that's always been heavily invested in the theater. And if you look at the resume, has actually really, like, accomplished a great deal and a great diversity of work, and is in a cool place right now where he's doing great work on television, but also he's about to go do a Arthur Miller play and at the Old Vic in London next year. He's in Adam McKay's new movie, which we talk about, which I should mention, it's called Vice. We talk about it towards the end. And for context, if you don't know about this movie, you're going to hear about it very soon. It's about Dick Cheney, basically, hence the title Vice. And it stars Christian Bale as the title character and has Sam Rockwell and Steve Carell and this crazy cast. And it includes Bill Pullman. So anyway, that's the main conversation on today's episode. And I think you'll enjoy it. If you love Bill Pullman half as much as I do, I think you'll get a kick out of it. He is, as you would expect, super affable, super smart, super cool. As for Toronto Film Festival shenanigans, just to mention it, because I did see so many films there, and I'm happy to say, by and large, really good movies. I was seeing, like, I don't know, between 2 and 4 movies a day, and that's a lot, especially after, like, a week and a half, of solid work. But I was heartened by the fact that, for the most part, it was really good stuff. I certainly saw a bunch of the big fall movies that are hitting soon. Widows is great, starring Viola Davis. First Man with Ryan Gosling and Claire Foy. Roma, directed by Alfonso Cuarón, is fantastic. Maybe my favorite film I've seen this year, possibly. Also, Can You Ever Forgive Me, which may or may not be on your radar yet, is directed, I believe, by Mariel Heller, who did Diary of a Teenage Girl, and it is her follow-up, and it stars Melissa McCarthy and Richard E. Grant, and tells a story of a woman who forged literary letters, you know, by luminaries. And it's a real kind of like great character piece about New Yorkers kind of on the fringes. It definitely appealed to like my, my love of New York and also just of quirky characters. That's one to watch. Melissa McCarthy is fantastic in more of a dramatic role than you're used to seeing her in. And Richard E. Grant, who has always been fantastic, finally kind of gets a plum of a role after, I feel like it's been a while since we've seen Richard E. Grant in a great role, and hopefully he's going to get some awards buzz for that. So those are some top line items for you. Some movies to look out for: Roma, First Man, Widows, Can You Ever Forgive Me, and a whole lot more to come. A lot of the films I saw also don't have distribution yet, so you'll see those films down the road. If you want to see any of my conversations with interviews with the likes of, oh my God, who did we talk to? We talked to the entire Widows cast. We talked to my soulmate, Michael Shannon. We talked to Alexander Skarsgård and Jamie Dornan. All of those interviews are on MTV News' YouTube page. So go check those out. A lot of fun. And of course, if you listen to last week's podcast, you listen to two of the conversations with Elizabeth Moss and Timothée Chalamet. So, an embarrassment of riches for you guys. If you couldn't make it to the Toronto Film Festival, you at least get to see some cool conversations and hear some amazing filmmakers and actors talk about it. So yes, that's Toronto. And today's event, as I said, Bill Pullman. Before I throw to that, a reminder: review, rate, and subscribe to Happy Say I Confuse. Spread the good word. Lots of cool conversations coming up. If you love the show, keep listening and tell your friends. Don't be a hog, you know, like share it with your friends. Let other people enjoy the conversations too. Come on. Here he is, the one and only Mr. Bill Pullman. I'm very pleased to be welcomed. I'm very pleased to welcome Bill Pullman to my strange little office on a rainy day in New York.
Well, I like what you said. To be welcome. So I need to say welcome to you.
Thank
to your
you,
own
Bill.
Office.
Bill, you're the host of Happy Say I Confuse, my podcast today. Thank you for having me on.
That's glad to be here.
Such an admirer of your work, and I'm a new fan of The Sinner. I have to confess, I only started watching The Sinner after I got you booked on this little show, and I'm hooked. I watched season two in like 2 days, except for the finale, of course.
Whoa,
yeah,
good.
It's good stuff, man. Congratulations.
Very good. Thank you.
I'm going to position this mic a little more so they can hear your delicious voice.
Yeah.
We don't want to deny the audience that.
Put the cord over there.
So I didn't introduce you as Bull Pillman as much as I wanted to, because that's still one of my favorite videos ever online.
Is what?
Do you remember the Bull Pillman introduction?
It happens a bunch of times. Was it at the
Will Smith thing? Oh, my God.
The voice of God saying, and now Bull Pillman.
Yeah, every 6 months or so, my wife and I pull up that clip and just laugh for about half an hour.
I recovered, kind of, didn't I?
You really did. No, that's what sells it. Otherwise, it's just like a silly goof, but you made the most of that moment.
Yeah. I haven't been called bull since college
or something like that. Is that like the worst nightmare of an actor to, like, in that kind of environment, you know, where supposedly everybody in the room loves and respects all your work, have your name butchered to death?
Yes. It's really strange, but it's amazing how often people do it. Like Letterman did it, you know,
really?
Bill. You know, it's too much to go into every time. But right. That one was, that was an outrageous night for Will Smith. And there was, you know, all these
some
brilliant
kind of thing
comics, you know, one after another. Black guys that are like riffing and black women that are just know how to control the crowd and work them up. And then me,
and I was the whitest like, man on the planet, Bull Pillman.
The Bull Pillman of it all. What a stiff pill that is. He's going to be a pill to take here.
You made the most of it. I also, here's a revelation I just had recently. I just saw a film, Bad Times at the El Royale. I had no idea until I was doing research on you just now that I was watching a very talented son of yours in a very pivotal role in that film.
Yes.
It's a big part for him in his career.
Big part. Yeah. That was one of those ones where he's been going strong and everything, but that was one of those few roles, you know, as the agent said, this is the one role that actors your age really want and are going to be fighting for. And I think there was, you know, a couple, 300 people that had, you know, been narrowed down by the casting person, and then they narrowed it down to 140, and then, you know, but damn it, he got it.
Do you feel like more anxiety, pride, anything about his career at this point than your own? Like, do you suffer the way you did early on in your career about the ups and downs, the challenges that he's facing relatively young in his career?
Well, you know, there's something about him that is his own game. He has his own integrity. At 25, I was not capable of the kind of composure that he can muster. And not that it's easy for him or he's facile at all, because it does, you know, at the heart of it, you know, there's a good performer has an edge of some kind of anxiety about different things, but he can also be very calm and everything, and he isn't driven by fame. Yeah, he's not driven by fame. So
did you bring your kids to sets growing up? Like, was that just like part and parcel of the
I don't know if that ever meant anything to him, but we did bring him to the sets. Yeah, I mean, I remember choosing to do Casper so that the kids could finally come to a set after I'd been all this terrible.
Didn't bring them
stories.
To Lost Highway? Didn't bring them to
like all these terrible movies, Malice or something, you know? But and then when we did Lake Placid, you know, that we were out in this beautiful lake outside of Vancouver, and I had my camper, you know, the trailer for the to shoot, and I just said, you know, we should just stay here. And so they let us, and we had all the boats and everything that the movie was using, prop department. They left us all these great canoes and everything, and everybody just went home, and we stayed on the shore side where the set was. And, you know, I think those kind of things really.
Yeah.
And there was a very cool caterer who had a great, and it was in the days of burning CDs, and he burned a CD for Lewis and invited Lewis on the catering truck. And so maybe that's his real memory of being on set.
Right, getting cool mixed CDs from the catering staff.
Yeah, who's cooking and playing tunes.
Always befriend Crafty. That's the important thing. It's so funny. It's weird. Like, Lake Placid's come up twice now in the last few weeks on this podcast. Brendan Gleeson was just here.
Oh.
And he, and it's funny, he's working with David E. Kelly now on a TV show and has very fond recollections, like all kind of come full circle on that.
Oh, I forgot that David's doing this. What is the name of the show?
It's Mr. Mercedes. Yeah. It's in its second season, and he's excellent in it, as he always is, of course.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, you know, growing up, you grew up in upstate New York, correct me if I'm wrong, right?
Yeah.
Hornell.
Yeah.
Which, in my research, I feel like you and Bob Crane are the most notable actors to come out of Hornell.
Bob Crane did, yes. Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that, I've forgotten that, because who is it that, Gabby Hayes comes from Wellsville, which was, you know, maybe 25 miles away, but 20 miles away. So, yeah.
Yeah, because I went to school, probably not so far away. I went to school in Geneva, New York, Hobart College. So, like, what's up there? What's up around there? What's the...
Hobart College.
That's the claim to fame. Hopefully not. Hopefully there's more than that.
Well, there's Alfred University and Alfred State, which are in one... Those are small but very potent places of higher learning. Mm-hmm. And... you know, it's a little bit, you know, in the center when it starts the second act and they talk about it being the burnt over district.
Yeah.
That's just something that really means a lot to me because there was, you know, it was an area that it was a hotbed of fervor in the 1800s. And, but somebody would evangelize, everybody would get fired up by it, it'd die out, another one would come in, and, you know, it happened over and over, and they called it the burnt out district. And it's not the Finger Lakes. It's west of the Finger Lakes a little bit, but it's kind of on the edge. And so we're really, I think of it as the Allegheny Plateau, which is it's a plateau that geologically it is one of the few in the United States, only two, I think, in the eastern sea and eastern coast. And they're all, you know, very lyrical. It's the top part of the Appalachian mountain chain.
So growing up there, was there like an affection for that region, or was there a sense of, I need to get out of here? I know you're the sixth of seven. Arts wasn't necessarily like in the family. It's more medicine was really in the Pullman blood.
Yes, very good. Yes. No, I think it was a place of, you know, because it had had a glory. Our town was a place where the railroad did a lot of repairs to engines. And so it's halfway between Chicago and New York, and it had 15,000 people at one point. And that's shrunk now to 8,000. Oh, wow. So that's like an apocalyptic event, you know, the, yeah. and the Rust Belt kind of thing. But, you know, then self-esteem in a place like that. But I brought all that, you know, they wanted to talk about that, the writers and Derek for, you know, you're playing a detective from a small town in Western New York State, and what can you tell us about that?
You're the on-set expert.
Yeah.
Did anybody else in, among your brothers or sisters pursue the arts, or were you the outlier there?
I have an oldest brother who was an English teacher, and he paints now, and really good painter. Nice. But that's it. The rest are in medicine, caregiving.
So what accounts for, you think, your more than interest, your passion for the arts? I mean, was the art something that was important to your parents, or was it...
You know, I don't without the word own. The arts wasn't even a word then. I mean, it's so amazing. You know, we basically, you know, shared a sense of humor with my brothers and sisters, mostly my brothers, you know, that had, and we were huge fans of Jonathan Winters. And
sure.
In those days, we listened to more 33 RPMs, you know, albums of comedy from Jonathan Winters, you know.
Yeah.
And those routines would crack us up. And I've never put this together until right now, but that really might have been more important than any movie I saw. We didn't watch a lot of television or anything else, but, you know, anecdotes about people and, you know, that was our thing. And, you know, Jonathan Winters, you know. It's a used pet shop. They got a lot of used pets here. Here's a dog, got no claws on his right paw. Got to lean him against some conversation. You know, all this stuff from Jonathan Winters' albums that we'd all say to each other and crack each other up. And just, you know, the voices. And I'm Marley Fricker, the oldest living airline stewardess. You know, that stuff is like it burned into my brain.
Yeah. So you weren't, I mean, high school, by the time even high school comes around, you're not articulating yet, like, what you want to do with your life. Maybe you don't even know it at that point.
No, and I was bucking the family's tradition of going to, you know, a lot of my family went to Wesleyan College.
And great school, yeah. Yeah,
Pullman there went there in 1856,
Gosh.
And I went to a two-year vocational college for building construction. That was like, what? Right turn. Where are you going? And then followed some refrigeration students to an audition for a play and got cast. And the guy, Bill Campbell, who was the director there, really was one of those people that step into your life and you suddenly are pivoting and you're doing things that you had never dreamed of. And he said, you're going to do what I did. You're going to go to college in Oneonta. It's 22 miles away, State University of College of New York in Oneonta, and get a degree in theater and then get a master's or something, and then come back and teach at a place like Delhi. It's a good life, Pullman. You'll like it. And I did that.
See, and you were a young teacher, presumably. You must have been in your 20s, probably. Mid-20s.
Yeah, very. Well, I was 2 years in the graduate school, and then he called and said, you got to take over my position for a year, you know, so hold it for me so I can get it when I come back after I have to get higher education. And so I went back to I did exactly what, you know, and then I finished a graduate degree and I thought I'd be in educational theater or something. And I was in Montana. I taught for 2 years at Montana State University and really fell in love with Montana. I made a lot of my longtime friends are from Montana now from those years in the 70s. And, then, you know, just said, I can't do that. I'm going to have to. If I don't leave now, I'll never leave. It's so beautiful here. And got in the pickup truck, and my wife, who wasn't my wife at the time, but my girlfriend at the time, and she's a dancer. And we just, you know, drove to New York City.
Drove to New York.
Yeah.
And so then just sort of dove in auditioning for theater as much as you could, just trying. Because, I mean, and we'll get to the film stuff, you know, but that doesn't occur till you're 32, 33, your film debut. So there's some life you've lived before then.
You hadn't prepared for this.
No, amateur, man.
I'm starting to...
are you unnerved? Are you scared?
Yeah, well, it's so accurate. It's so facile. You really are... I mean, I can barely remember my own life.
I'm here to correct all the mistakes you make in this conversation. Then you did this. No. But so I guess my point is, like, So that's a lot of years where you're like, you know, A, you're teaching, and then like, so like what age did you come to New York?
That was when I was, I guess I was 80, 81 would be 28. Okay. Yeah, 28.
So then we're still talking like a good 4 years before you set foot on a film set. So are those happy times, kind of like toiling and trying to find work in theater? And are there odd jobs that are kind of like filling in the gaps, or what's happening?
Yeah, the survival jobs, you know, in New York City. And I had been a teacher. I couldn't tell anybody that, you know, because I was doing grunt work. I was carrying boxes in liquor stores and, you know, selling wine. And I had no reason to do that. And, you know, working for the New York Times in the poll department at night, you know. But it's very ecstatic to be in New York City. I still get this jump, you know, just being here now. I'm reminded about all the ways in which it was such a privilege to, you didn't care where you lived,
right?
You know, you just cared what you did, you know, where you could insert yourself into, and, you know, they wouldn't kick you out right away. But
was it thrilling to both to be exposed to the theater in New York, both as an audience member and to start to like get some roles? I mean, that's got to be.
Yeah, I think I. You know, there was a part of it that I just really loved, the exhaustion that happened, or the kind of like coming down off of having done a play, have a beer in your hand, you know, it's like, yeah, we did it.
I made it. I'm barely scraping by, but I made it.
I forded this beer, I can drink
it. What more do I need?
And I had no idea about television or film.
Yeah.
I had no aspiration. I had it wasn't in my vision or anything. I don't know if people didn't have dreams then, or just I didn't have any.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, why wouldn't you? I mean, like, it's not like.
Yeah, I wanted to be paid to be a theater actor.
Yeah.
You know, get enough money to live and support myself, you know, and had got out of town jobs first. And then I had to make the decision, oh, I'm going to have to turn work down or stay in New York, because it's going to really mostly, I'm not going to get anywhere unless I stay here. I can't be. And so I put in enough hours, I felt competent and everything, and then it was a play that brought me to L.A. You know, I went to do a play by Bill Master Simone, and it was part of a new theater complex, and I went out there and got, I had some debt and everything, and got a first Cagney and Lacey episode, mm-hmm. and I cleared my debts and said, this is not bad, being debt-free.
What was it like to be on a TV set, and then soon thereafter you're in a great movie that I remember from my youth, Ruthless People, from the Zucker Brothers and Jim Abrams, right? Where you play like a consummate moron, like a classic idiot.
Yeah.
Really? So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Do you remember feeling comfortable on film and TV sets at first? I mean, you'd done a lot of theater by then. Did it feel like this was an environment that was totally different? Or?
Well, you know, I was just trying to hang on, you know, white knuckling it and everything. And I later heard from the writer, Dale Lawner, who said, did you know you were almost fired?
This is on Ruthless People?
Yeah. Because we had gone to shoot my first scene in Griffith Park. And it was a night scene in which my character is watching two people in a car, and he thinks that the police of chief police is brutalizing her, and all the noises are dying, but it's actually they're having sex.
Right.
I get so repulsed by it, I throw up at the side of the road. And we were waiting and waiting and waiting, and they had a big 10K up there lighting up the whole side. And I think it was the same night as Halley's Comet. So there were like, you know, thousands of people up there, all of them looking down at this movie that was being shot, waiting for Halley's Comet. And I just, wow, this is like the Coliseum. Yeah, this is really. And we shot wide. We shot the big master, and then we ran out of time. We had to come back to it the next night. And apparently, they said, I don't think he's not doing it. You know, we took a risk. We cast him. He's never worked before. He's not doing it. And then somebody, and I never found out who it was, just said, well, let's wait one more night and see how it does when we come in. And they came in close, and then they were like, oh, no,
He's actually doing something.
He's doing something.
Does that jive with, like, your memory? Do you feel like you didn't, like, know what you were doing at first, or it was...
I don't remember. I remember thinking... I never thought that I would be fired. I hadn't thought of that. But I did think that I don't really know what I'm doing, but I'm going to listen, and whatever they do, I'm going to try to apply myself to. And but I didn't, you know, and they all were kind of enjoying it and everything, but it was really only after the movie started to test and people said, you know, your character. And I thought, this is weird. Does this happen in every movie? A small character gets so much attention. But there was something about that role that just was getting an abnormal. And they said it's abnormal.
I remember, like, I was probably, well, it came out like 86 or something like that. So I'm 10 years old. And I literally remember seeing it with my older brother and, like, just... I think there's the moment when you're looking at, like, the ID and that, like, stupid photo of yourself, and you say, cool, in a certain way. And I just remember, like, saying that back and forth with my older brother. And just, like, whatever you were doing, it worked. And it did jump off the screen.
And I think that's what Mel Brooks saw that. Yeah. And he said, there's something interesting about that, and we'll give him a shot. And so to rocket into Spaceballs was a big deal, beyond the lot of MGM, you know, when it was still MGM, one of the last movies shot on the lot when it was called that. And it was a great little window. But to think, oh my God, and, you know, you realize how sometimes it happens, you know, people get fired, and it could have happened
that close. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure a slew of memories from Spaceballs. I mean, I've heard you talk about affectionately working with John Candy, who kind of, like, went out of his way to take care of you a bit.
Yeah. This last summer was the 30th anniversary, so I wrote that piece for the New York Times.
Right. That was very sweet. Very sweet. And then, of course, like, working with, like, a brilliant intellect like Mel. Also having to, like, work opposite him as Yogurt in all that makeup. What do you remember about, like, working opposite him in that getup?
Well, you could see that he really, he could, the sharp edges of delivering a line.
Yeah.
You know, he really, it's a really bold style that comes out of vaudeville in the ancient ways, you know, and probably there's people that can't pull it off, most people, but there's something about his ability that made it. I realized, wow, this guy, he makes me laugh.
Yeah. So by then, did it feel like you were off to the races, that it's sort of like you were on kind of like a track that you didn't need to steer, that it was just sort of like the career is underway, there are offers, there's interest from a variety of great directors, and this is just what the career is going to be, and I'll just ride the wave? Or did you feel in control of it, or what?
I didn't, didn't really... It was the third thing was the Serpent and the Rainbow,
right?
Which was such a
big Wes Craven.
Wes Craven, we shot in Haiti and in the Dominican Republic, and I thought, wow, this movie making is so adventurous, and you know, and then there was a bunch of years in which there weren't anything as adventurous as that. You know, they were really, you know, I was doing interesting movies and interesting things, but they weren't that level, you know, and.
Less edgy, but more like you were kind of like in that mainstream of like classic kind of like studio comedies, romantic comedies. You know, you got Penny Marshall and Nora Ephron. I mean, these are great talents, but they all also are kind of like within the framework of like when we think of like classic Hollywood movie making, that's what they are.
Yeah. That's a very, then there was the period in which they said, you know, second male lead, you know, you're the guy who doesn't get the girl, and that whole thing. And then
Bother you? Did that, like, when you sort of,
you know, not when I was doing them, and then somebody started it, and it was like a buzz thing that people just said, oh yeah, hey, that's right, you know. It's, and I had never heard, you know, really thought of Ralph Bellamy as being like this quintessential person that I always thought, he's up in the sky going, wait, what's wrong with Ralph Bellamy?
hey,
I got work. I paid for my house. Yeah. You know, what's wrong with that? There was a facileness that, you know, people didn't even know who Ralph Bellamy was or what he'd been in, but they were quoting him and they're saying that I was like him. And it's, you know, these little memes now, I guess you'd call them, in people's heads, they get spread around. And so I was, while You're Sleeping came up, it was a great change to go, wow, this is perfect.
That's one of those movies that I feel like 30% of the time when I come back to my apartment, my wife is watching that movie. Like, legitimately, somehow she finds the channel it's on and it will never stop being played. And that was a surprise. I mean, that was like the definition of a sleeper hit, I remember, at the time. That kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Sandra Bullock was not Sandra Bullock then.
Right.
So did that all shock you in terms of like the way that developed into something like the memory? What I'm always intrigued by in that film is like this. You've got this also great ensemble. These like older actors too. You got Jack Warden and Peter Boyle. So that's got to be rewarding too.
Yeah. Peter was a great guy. I worked with him a couple times.
Did you?
And yeah, very. He came from a great school and theater of acting and everything. Great joy about it. Jack did too. Glennis Johns, you know, great British actress who had been an ingenue, you know, with Alec Guinness and everything. I just had, remember hearing
the stories on that set must have been amazing.
Somebody that knew, I know somebody that knew Alec Guinness. This is fantastic. Yeah, this is really, really good. And John Turteltaub, who was young director, and there was quite a bit of drama around trying to get the script to work for us, and John really was part of why it has its magic. I think he was really great at like taking a pretty straight ahead script and encouraging us to make it specific. And just that conclusion of that newspaper boy on the bicycle, mm-hmm. Throws the newspaper and crashes,
right?
And no explanation, we're moving on. Such a kind of feel of freedom and everything. So
another one from that era I do want to mention that some people mention, but maybe not enough to my liking. I really like Malice a lot. I've always had a great affection for Malice.
Yeah.
And it didn't surprise me, I guess, too much when I went back and looked. And I think the script was by, was Sorkin one of the co-writers?
Yeah. No, he wrote it.
He wrote it.
Sorkin, yeah.
A very smart, kind of like Hitchcockian, great film directed by Harold Becker.
Shot by Gordon Willis.
Oh, it's gorgeous. What's he known as, like, the Master of Darkness? And that is one of those films that's, like, steeped in darkness, but it's great.
Yeah,
And a different kind of a role for you, I would think, right?
Yeah. Well, it was, it was, in a way, that was one of the roles that they said, oh, he didn't get the girl. But I didn't understand that. Like, I was married to the girl, but then it turns out she was with Alec Baldwin, but then it turns out that I sent her to prison. So, I got the best of that.
Yeah. I
wasn't landed on my back bleeding or something. You know?
It's true. I also wanted to mention, So you taught, one of your students was John Dahl way back when.
Yes.
Who went on to direct you in another great noir, Last Seduction.
Yeah.
What was did you have, a relationship with John going back that, was sustained through the years?
No, that wasn't, because then I had been teaching, and then I went to New York City. And then I came to L.A., and at a certain point, he showed up, and he had been at that, there was a film company called Propaganda Films, and they were doing a lot of videos and everything, and music videos, and there was another part that I think we were talking about doing, and I couldn't do it, and then when Last Seduction came, I said, yeah, and love to do it, and so it was really, we had the easy way of fitting back into each other. And then I did another couple things with him.
Did you?
Okay. Yeah, did a TV series that he called
I know what you're
Fallen
Angels. Angels. Yep.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And did an episode of that with Heather Graham and other people. And then went to do You Kill Me.
Yes.
With Ben Kingsley.
That was only about 10 years ago or so, I want to say, right? Yeah. I remember that one as well. We can't ignore Independence Day. That's one of those films that, again, follows an actor around in a good way. I mean, what are your recollections of, delivering that now iconic speech? Was that tough to kind of figure out a way to deliver that satisfied you, that felt right? Or did it kind of sell itself on the page?
I think it was I remember thinking, this is kind of corny.
Well, it kind of leans into it. Even the music, it leans into the corniness, I think.
Yeah. And I had gotten a CD collection of the greatest, 100 greatest speeches of the 20th century. And they had the speech by Robert Kennedy when he had been told that Martin Luther King was shot. And he extemporaneously.
Oh, it's an amazing. I've seen that speech recently, actually, for some reason. It's an amazing speech.
Yeah. Isn't that something? Yeah.
Yeah.
He quotes a Greek in it. He, you know, has that whole thing about, you know, I know many of you are just shocked that you've lost a brother, but I also lost a brother.
Right. You know. Amazing.
It's just, a, you know, and I think the sense of this is happening right now. This isn't a prepared speech. Right. I don't know what I'm going to say.
Right.
You know, this is, a, and you looking out at despair.
Yeah.
You know, people who are left as the fighter pilots and that kind of thing, imagining what Robert Kennedy must have been looking out at, you know, people that were suddenly, you know, black-white divisions, yeah. And everything was starting to gape open. And so I think the reality of that and everything helped, and it was also that they were going to call it Doomsday. And Dean Devlin and Roland moved the speech scene up earlier in the schedule so that they could get it, because they wanted the studio to, they were going to start sticking with Doomsday.
That was going to be the title of the film. I had no idea.
Yeah. And they said, this can't be Doomsday, you know. So we shot, you know, they said, move it up. And we shot it in the night, the darkest hour of the night, like 3-4 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
You know. And so, and then I remember going on and thinking, I think we did all right. And but then Dean came in with a VHS in those days and said, you want to see the cut scene? Because this is what we brought to Fox. And I think they're going to go for the title because of this. You watch it and tell me. If they don't go for Independence Day, they're stupid, you know.
That's amazing.
Today is your Independence Day. Yeah.
You literally made the title happen.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one of those roles that follows an actor around, and hopefully, for the most part, in a good way. Did it feel, is that, like, I was interested in talking to actors about, like, the good and the bad of those kind of iconic roles. Did it ever feel like an albatross, like a little bit of, like, I appreciate the love, but I've done some other things too.
yeah. There's usually like, can you come on and be, you know, in a comedy show and be a president? You know, it's right. Like, I don't need to.
I did that.
Yeah, I didn't feel like I want to do that. It's one of those things that because the people involved were all so close, you know, we were and all in kind of similar place. There wasn't a star vehicle or anything like that. So, and Roland, the filmmaker, is really quite a terrific person to work with. You know, I just, he has such an energy for the process and very, you know, gracious guy in a lot of ways. And Dean Devlin also, so loves movies, loves, you know, the thrill of it. And he, so, you know, we stayed together, and the idea of doing the sequel was great. And the sequel wasn't quite as successful as the first, but it was a chance to get together with everybody. And, you know, it's been a long time. I mean, get it out of our system.
Were you surprised that Spaceballs never came together as a sequel? Was there ever, like, an actual script shown to you for that one, or it just never got that far?
Never got that far, yeah. Lots of talk.
You know? Lots of talk. Okay, coming full circle, I mentioned at the outset that I'm a new convert to the Sinner, which is now concluding its second season. This is a great character. I would think this is something that you're really enjoying. It occurs to me, like, you've, outside of theater, you've never played a character at this length.
No, I never get to come back to it, you know. It's very, and there was a lot of speculation whether it even happened, or if it was picked up, it didn't have to be.
It could have gone a bunch of different ways.
A whole new group of actors or something. But Derek Simons, you know, the runner, writer, and he really saw that he'd like to follow Ambrose, you know.
Yeah.
So that has been great. I feel, you know, so fortunate to be working with them, and that they seem to give me a lot of rope to hang myself with, and you know, permission to follow my instincts, and to, you know, there's so much, and I see the way the choices of takes they do, because I really do a range of takes, you know, to, and we usually kind of have a sliding scale that's somewhere about, you know, how uncomfortable in your own skin are you?
Oh, interesting. You know? Yeah. Is that generally your practice on a set, to like give the director a few different options, as opposed to coming to set with, like, this is the one specific viewpoint I have of this, or is it particular to this character you think it works?
I think that particular aspect of it is in this character. I mean, because it's, you know, it's challenging because, you know, dialogue has to be written so quickly, and there is a sense of facileness. And then, you know, there's the monster of TV is the fact that, you know, the plot is a cookie monster. It eats everything. It eats up specificity of character. Yep. It eats up all the stuff. And it just, it's really sometimes just relieving that you're getting all these story points in, you know? And I hate that. You know, I hate exposition. Yeah. I hate the procedural part of it. I want to. And the good thing is that he's a small town cop, so he doesn't use. You know, it's easy to write. You know, give him a GDP. You know, yeah. Did you call in the SBRI? And you know, it's like I don't. I think he's just still calling it. Like, did you call in the, you know, description of the guy or you know something like that. It's because it's kind of a crutch to be that specific. It's even though it's more specific, it's more generic.
Yeah,
because it's like any procedure has that talk.
Right. You wouldn't do well with like a captain of a starship on Star Trek with all that techno babble. That might drive you insane.
I am friends with Scott Bakula.
Oh yeah,
and I always look at him and go, how the you do it, you motherfucker. You know, you've got all, it's like Shakespeare. No, it's not like Shakespeare. It's like a lot of shit you gotta say. And I can't do it.
Get to the good stuff, get to the good character stuff. And this, one of the cool things is like, this guy, in many ways, is kind of as fucked up as the cases he's looking at. He's got his own demons that he's dealing with. That's kind of why he's like relating to the victims and the suspects as much as anything.
Yeah.
I'm curious because it's like also one of those characters that like carries some secrets that are like kind of revealed as the show goes on. Are you the kind of actor that like whether it's written into the script or not, like you like to have a secret about the character? I've heard actors talk about that, like something that they'll never even necessarily reveal to a director or on camera, but it's helpful for them to kind of nail the specificity of a character.
I think so. You know, that everybody's got to do a certain amount of that or something. I think. Partly because you're trying to do a facsimile of real life and the spontaneity of real life.
Right.
And the truth is that there's a lot of contradictory thoughts going on in your head as you're talking, you know. And that level of saying one thing and thinking about another thing is, you know, part of reality. And if you're a distracted person or if you're a person who's living some kind of denial about who they really are, that when they get, they have little radar going off, don't reveal. So they're talking about, you know, and one of the things I always love is when people say, can I be frank with you? And you know you're not going to get
it. Yeah, once you hear that. Okay, so like, we're not going to be frank. Okay, got it.
Go ahead and lie. And I think, you know, that sense of, you know, I mean, it's elementary, but, you know, it's something about lines, you know, that feels primary, and fortunately, and we're in an environment where, you know, it's not sometimes what you say, it's your reaction to what's said, and,
right,
you know, keeping that in mind, and Derek keeps that in mind. All the directors have really been great, and they're always saying, you know, if there's something that's really hard to say, you know, they said, well, what would you like to say with it? And we don't have time to change these words to kind of get this thing right, so say that. But is subtext for what you're saying, you know,
right.
And just start helping us all to articulate that, you know, so that we can keep it, you know, all kind of in the zone about, you know, finding the truth of every line.
Was that a concern when you kind of jumped into this kind of an ongoing potential series that, like, again, it's, I think, you know, as much as we talk about this amazing, glorious golden age for television, it's the time. It's all about time in the end. And like, if you don't have time to kind of like have those discussions and to kind of loosen up a scene and play with it, to be so rigid with dialogue and to just sort of like feel like a puppet is probably your worst nightmare as an actor, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that was a great fear. I hadn't really signed on to very much that would put me in that thing. I just thought, I've got everything I need. I got my house paid for.
Right.
I don't need to work for money, you know, really. That's, you know, that kind of money to just take a job because you need to keep the flow going or something. And so I But this was so different, you know. Yeah. This is so different. The botany thing, which I really love, and you know, it's amazing. I was reading this great book called The Wonder of Birds by Jim Robbins, who's a New York Times science writer about birds, and there was a great chapter on murmurations, and I was talking about murmurations, and lo and behold, in episode 7, there's a murmuration.
Amazing.
I'm in the hotel, and I'm looking out, and then this flock of starlings are flipping around, and you know, thousands of birds moving, and no one's crashing. What is that? You know, it's a real, and so to have that, to be so kind of being kind of farmed for stuff, you know, and it was really, really great.
You also have performed in a film that I'm very much looking forward to this fall with a director that I know is pretty fluid. I've been on some of his sets, Adam McKay, I think it's now called Vice.
It's called Vice?
Yeah, they called Vice, as in, I assume, Vice President, who's telling the story of Cheney.
Oh, that's so good. They were dead. Just the title thing has been flipping.
I know it was like Backseat for a while, and then they just didn't have a title. And apparently, it's called Vice.
Yeah.
So there's news to both of us, I guess.
That's very, you're the first I heard it from you. Yeah.
So I couldn't be more curious about this one. What was the environment like on set of that one? You're playing, I believe, Nelson Rockefeller, correct?
Yes, yeah. If you were on the set.
I wasn't on set of this one, but I've been on past Adam McKay sets, and so I know the way he works. But I've seen the way he works in comedies, like full-on comedy, so I don't know if it's a different environment on something like this.
Is there
a bullhorn involved? Is he screaming different dialogue?
Is he really? Well, he's got it more sophisticated. He's got ghetto blasters, and he's got a microphone that he holds. You know, but it's the voice of God coming over and saying, you know, now say it's a big tomato stuck up your ass. Now say... say, you know, if I could get that up your ass, just in certain times, you know, dropping into a moment or something, and then other times, but so free, and I've gone back and added narrating sessions of the movie.
Oh, cool.
And I said, why are we doing this? I mean, I'm not, you haven't met me, nobody's met Nelson Rockefeller. And he goes, I know, I like that part. Yeah.
So do you have a sense of what that film's going to be or look like? Or is that one of those things where it could be anything in the hands of McKay and the editor?
I think, you know, it's like catch your breath, you know, what? Oh, my God. You know, there's just a kind of freedom that's dazzling and compelling, you know. And to have these kind of doing some kind of, and there's a way in which, you know, politics in America can feel Shakespearean, you know. And people would say that that's Shakespearean, but no one would say there's actually a section where it feels really like Shakespeare, like Shakespeare.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm spoiling anything, but it's like so free and things that would shift and all with a laugh and a giggle and just a big embrace of life. You know, he's got so much life in him and he's so intelligent and he really, you know, cares deeply about politics and everything, but he can make fun of everything and nobody's sacred, you know. In a way, Nelson Rockefeller is like, you know, there were Rockefeller Republicans and they were environmentalists and they were, you know, people don't remember that they were, you know, pro-education. They worked with labor and everything. And at a certain point, he became, he had to be disposed of. And the party took a hard right. And so, you know, in a way, Nelson is a thing of anomaly nowadays when you look back, but I think he, even that, you know, he's not a saint to Adam McKay. It's like we're all complicated people doing complicated things as we die.
Right. I couldn't be more fascinated. Please, that cast, Christian Bale and Sam Rockwell, it's going to be fascinating, I'm sure, to say the least, and fun, I would imagine, in the hands of McKay. You're also, we've talked a bunch about theater throughout. I just want to mention, I think you're going to be headed to London next year, right? Acting opposite Sally Field and Arthur Miller's All My Sons, is that right?
Yeah. I like to get on the boards and to be in London. I studied there as a student in the 70s. And
have you ever done a play there at the Old Vic?
No. That's going to be a moment. I've done a play there in London and it's the Old Vic and everything. Though I did remember very vividly listening to an interview with Anthony Hopkins when they, he was doing Science Slams and they said, what's your version of hell? And he goes, Playing a matinee at the old Vic on a rainy afternoon.
Well, he notoriously hates the theater. Like, once he left the theater, he was like, I'm never going back. Movies was it for him. That's,
right.
That doesn't describe you. You're somebody that it seems like still has a great affection for.
Yeah, theater. Yeah. No, it did scare the shit out of me. Yeah.
You and Tony can be different in some ways. It's okay.
Right, yeah. No, I think it's a great play, and there's great, you know, I have such respect for their sense of theater and everything. I am also very arrogantly proud of American theater actors. You know, I just saw a play the other night, last night, two nights ago. The True, as with Edie Falco, Michael McKean, and Peter Scolari, and oh my God, this is like acting, American acting at its best. Yeah. You know, they're just tearing up Johnny Polanco and Benko, and really everybody's kind of astounding, and the words are great, and it's about politics in Albany in 1977, and I thought, what is this going to be? And it's just compelling as hell, revealing about human nature. It's a love triangle of a really special variety, and I just think, well, I'll go and be with the Brits, and I gotta, you know, I'm proud of our tradition and American actors, and I hope I can be part of that and meet them in their best, because the rest of them are Brits, you know, that'll pretty much, that'll be in the cast. Yeah, they do great American accents, and, you know, they're pretty handy.
Does theater still, like, satisfy something in you that's a little bit different than the film or TV work? Is there still something you get out of it that's satisfying in a different way?
I think, yeah, there's it's a great sense of freedom. You know, in a way, you're a director, you're the editor, you're the, right, you know, you're the sound guy, you've got all that stuff, and you're playing with it. So it's a, you know, there's a sense of control and then a sense of freedom that you give yourself or you wait to find, or, you know, and it's very humbling, you know, very crazy how bad you can be for how so long, and there's no faster way to do it. There's like technology hasn't improved.
How right.
You can't go any faster than what it takes to find the play and find your character in relationship to everybody else, and you know, that's pretty daunting. But when I turned 60, I wanted to do a whole year of plays, and I did a bunch and ended up in the last play that I did, in fact, it was in Norway.
I was going to say, how did that... We'll end on this note, because I know I'm taking up a lot of your time. But yeah, how do you end up doing an extended run in Norway on stage? It seems like
doing the part of Othello in Othello.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was because I had worked with this Norwegian theater director like 28 years before, and I always is in my mind. And so when I was doing this thing about, you know, people, whether they buy a Mazda convertible or something when they turn 60, I don't think that's going to do it for me. And
I'm going to do some Norwegian theater of Othello. That's my Mazda. That's my
thing. Oh, my God. And he's such a physical, the theater director. And but it was in the National Theater in Bergen, you know, Ibsen's theater. And, you know, there's a part of me that, you know, feels that the spirits of the ghosts that are in there are also climbing around inside me. And, it, you know, it was a really transformational thing. It literally, to just perform it, I lost so much weight, gained so much strength. I mean, it was like I changed my whole body and everything. And it was bilingual, so I had to speak some Norwegian and English. And
testing yourself in every way.
It was so huge. It kind of made me think I don't need to do another play for a while.
Right.
You know? It's like, well, kill me. I had done the Sticks and Bones just before that. I had done one that... called Healing War, that it was, you know, really, and so I thought, that's it. But then this came up, and it feels right. The timing feels right.
Yeah.
I got an itch for it. So.
It's got to be like a great point in a career where, like, you were kind of alluding to this before, like, you have this amazing body of work and this great breadth of material on stage and screen, where it's like you don't have to chase being something at this point. You know what I mean? Like, you're Bill Pullman, and like, you have that body of work and people know it, and it's not like you have to go after being Tom Cruise. You can do Norwegian theater if, like,
it's so good. Right? Yeah, nobody's you know, the role police aren't blowing their whistles at me, you know. And right. I did this, the Ballad of Lefty Brown, in December. Yeah. This western where he's a Walter Brennan type character, yeah. sidekick who becomes the hero, and then this trouble is a eccentric character. He's smoking pot and he's, you know, firing from both with both pistols, you know, and so I feel like I'm going through a lucky period in which that kind of thing seems to, you know, it's never really evenly paced or sure. anything. It just happens to be where they're, you know, congealed in this particular time period. But it's a great privilege to feel like, well, you know, nobody's going to say he's the boy next door, the guy that didn't get the girl. I mean, that's like, just please. Yeah, you're in the dust.
Yeah, that narrative is long since passed, thankfully. It's been such a great pleasure to get to know you a little bit today. As you can tell, I've always been a fan of your work and continue to admire the choices that you're making. And everybody, if they haven't checked out The Sinner, go back mm-hmm. and check out season one, mm-hmm. season two, wrapping up right now. And hopefully we see more of Harry in seasons to come. Who knows?
And you know what I'm hopeful to see? You know, you set me up. There's a picture here, right here, of Michael Shannon in a little rabbit suit. And Bill. I'm imagining that someday you're going to ask me to get into some little animal outfit.
Don't make promises you're not willing to keep.
Okay. But you have to have me back to do that. Yes.
It's a date. Yeah. I'm gonna ruin your career at some point and put you in some horrible outfit. thanks for stopping by today.
You bet.
Thanks, man.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.